can't take this shit no more.
The HMB sites. Extra content available exclusively on HMB Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. I'm sitting down with Brendan McLaughlin. He's got a few more minutes. Let's get him in, get him out. He's got to work tomorrow. I kind of thought that once that you were done, it's like you came in at like 5. You came strolling in, and then you went home at 6.
Oh, no, my friend.
Back.
No. I show up. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at 9 a.m. We have a meeting. We have an editorial meeting to figure out what we're going to cover for that day. You want to come up with story ideas, and you make your pitch, you know. And if you make a good pitch and you got a good story, you can pretty much assign yourself. So I don't go out and do a story every day. It's 2 or 3 or sometimes 4 times a week. And otherwise, I work on other projects or I kind of work on my social media content, but you know, to prepare for the newscast, which for me amounts to an hour from 5:30 to 6:30, you know, I need about an hour to go through the show, go through all the scripts, and make sure everything's copacetic. We got great writers, great producers, and so on. But you know, before you read anything live on the air, it's good to have one pass through because you might come up against a name, or you know, a sentence that doesn't trip off your tongue, or a word that you don't typically use, a perfectly good word, but. You know, you want to write for your own voice.
You ever drop an F-bomb?
No, I never dropped an F-bomb, but I think I dropped an S-bomb, and I kind of muttered it. And after I did it, it was like, "What? Did I have a mini stroke or something? Why did I do that?" Nobody noticed. I mean, it didn't raise an eyebrow, and I was just too afraid to go back and look at the tape. But anyway, it's lost to history now.
Do you ever go on YouTube and look at these clips from anchors that screw up? Does that ever give you any joy?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it gives me great happiness to watch people have moments. You know, I think why people enjoy it is because it's a real moment. You know, it's
like
you catch people being themselves, whether they're freaking out because of a spider in the studio or the lizard.
The black dude with the lizard is one of my favorite things ever.
Weather guy? Yeah. Oh no, he was like an anchor, and then there was a weather guy who was flipping out about a fly or something, and. But yeah, and people like to see that because it cuts through the artifice, I guess.
Have you ever, what's like the best thing you've ever covered that gave you a lot of joy, and also the thing where you went home and you were just like, oh, God, humanity's terrible?
I have that feeling a lot. You know, you get kind of a gallows humor in news, you know, because you kind of have to. You're talking about some grim stuff, so... There's that kind of stuff going on in the newsroom. It's a defense mechanism. It's sort of the same thing ambulance drivers and, you know, police use. Not to equate what I do with that. That's the real thing. We're just talking about awful stuff. We're not, you know, knee-deep in it typically. But in terms of the best thing, I kind of scored a home run recently on a story that just took me by surprise. It was a guy who he cleans my carpets once a year. You know, have him come in and he does a couple carpets. He's a ChemDry guy. You know, I just called him up out of the Yellow Pages basically, or you know, Yelp, and he came and he's a chatty guy. And so we're talking and he says, "Hey, you know, might be kind of weird, but on my days off, I like to go out to cemeteries and clean the grave markers of veterans. You know, just a little thing I do. I don't tell anything, make a big fuss about it, but it makes me feel good, and I think they deserve it." And so I went, I thought that might be an interesting story idea. I wasn't necessarily anxious to work on a Sunday, but, you know, so about a month or two later, I finally called the guy and said, are you going out there this weekend? And he was. So I went out and I did this story. It was about a minute, 20 seconds long, and I put up on my Facebook page. It's at about 18.5 million hits now.
Wow.
Yeah, it went crazy. It got picked up by BuzzFeed and Reddit and everybody else. It truly went viral. Just hundreds of thousands of likes and tens of thousands of shares, and still getting emails about it every day from all over the world. So that was kind of fun. It was kind of gratifying because it was a good story, and it was a positive story about somebody doing something kind of selfless,
yeah,
and generous. Yeah,
that's always nice to hear because the world is in a weird place right now. I believe that we are in World War III right now. I think that this is the new way wars will be fought, through guerrilla tactics, online, after the Paris thing. I'm convinced that things are not going to be getting better anytime soon.
Well, okay. I hope you're wrong.
Me too. I hope I'm wrong, too.
I tend not to be as pessimistic, and maybe this is the advantage of age, Will, here a little bit, because I'm old enough to remember the Red Brigade, which was a terror organization in Europe in the 70s. And Carlos the Jackal was one of these, like, he was, you know, the sort of the terrorist, famous terrorist at the time. But they were opening up in airports with automatic weapons and restaurants and detonating bombs in Paris. They didn't have 160 or 129 fatalities, but still it was dozens and dozens of people getting killed in terror attacks throughout Europe. And
what was their motivation?
They were sort of anarchists, the Bader Meinhof group out of Germany. Okay. And they sort of shared this kind of nihilistic, anarchic point of view. But they were pretty much thugs more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And this went on for a decade. And it finally petered out.
Yeah.
I think this is a little deep, got deeper roots.
Yeah, know? Because those people believed in nothing. These people believe in a singular everything.
This is...
And there's no bargaining. There's no getting around it.
It's true. But I think it's going to run its course. People say, you know, well, if we wipe out ISIS, something worse could take its place. Well, yeah, and if it does, then, you know, we fight them too, and they peter out eventually.
I just don't know how you fight them. How do you fight ISIS? You can't go put boots on the ground. They don't have uniforms.
Well, no, you do it just exactly the way the French did it this morning. You use intelligence, and you find out where they are, and they arrested 8 or 10, and one woman blew herself up, and they killed one guy. And they believed that there was an imminent terror attack. So that's how you do it. They stopped the terror attack. They arrested a bunch of people. They got all kinds of intelligence. They're going to arrest tons more as a result of that. Mm-hmm. That's how you do it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not as optimistic. Yep. I watch and I research. It's very scary. Also, one of the things that I notice now is because of the refugees that are going on, I'm seeing a lot of people on Facebook really eager to have an opinion and to have a stance right away and not really think it out. And instead of calling the other side and explaining and coming to the table and talking and explaining your point of view to them, there's this absoluteness of you're a bigot now that's really flowing now. I don't know when that happened either, when we stopped talking to each other.
Yeah, well, I mean, social media posting doesn't lend itself to, because you're both sides are anonymous.
I think when it changed from Twitter.
They're not like you and me sitting across a table.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I have people, you know, put messages on my page and email me with things that they would never say to my face. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
It's like, so I always find that interesting. And that's sort of my barometer for whether I take the time to respond. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to be civil about it, we'll have a discussion. But yeah, I know what you're saying, and I think what you're alluding to is, you know, the Syrian refugee thing and people who are against a lot, you know, who call for stopping all, you know, admittance of Syrian refugees right now. Most of those people are not motivated by racism, but you know what? A lot are.
Some are, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm all for acknowledging that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them aren't. They haven't, maybe a lot of people haven't made up their mind yet, or they're afraid. And instead of using your words and speaking and explaining your point of view, it's just, well, you're a racist. You're a bigot.
Yeah, I agree. That's an ad hominem argument that pretty much stops any learning, right?
Yep. Yeah, no doubt. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I'm happy to give my opinion if asked. I don't even really want to. I'm afraid to say anything. I differ from a lot of my peers mm-hmm. in how I feel about stuff. The colleges, I'm so glad I'm not on a college campus now with all this stuff that's going on. I'm sure you're familiar with the Mizzou thing, the Yale thing,
right,
and now
right.
colleges all over the place. I was wondering if USF was going to do it, and they had a small thing. I don't think it
We covered that, yeah.
Yeah. So what were they upset about?
Well, it was more in solidarity with the students at Mizzou. It
so wasn't they weren't.
Necessarily, yeah, they weren't necessarily airing a gripe against USF necessarily.
I couldn't fathom, even a couple years ago when I was in school, screaming at the top of my lungs at a dean and getting, I don't understand why they let him get away with this type of stuff. They kowtowed to all these kids who, they're dumb. You know, we talked about it earlier, who have no life experience. They're at some of the most prestigious universities in the world and talk about how they're going to break their chains. They have nothing to lose but their chains. I just don't see it. There's this, I think it's a myth of this systematic racism and sexism that's going on. I don't see it in my day-to-day world.
Well, I do see it, Will.
Do you?
Yeah, I do see it. And you got to look for it, especially if you're white like us, because it's not part of our everyday experience. I'm not going to pontificate here, but there's nothing new about this. Again, I don't want to pull the old man card again, but, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area. The campus of UC Berkeley was, you know, full of this kind of stuff, you know, of really angry, disaffected students, you know, rebelling against the establishment. And in hindsight, yeah, you could say, you know, really? I mean, what did you have to worry about? Your middle class, your parents are putting you, you know, through university. And but, you know, racism and sexism, they're in the air.
I'm not saying that they don't exist, but I don't think there's a system of it working on a day-to-day.
Well, what is a system? I mean, is there a policy written down to oppress women and racial minorities? No, that's true. That's been taken care of, which is progress, you know, because it used to be written down. You know, these laws were codified. But just because those laws are no longer, you know, written down or in stone or in paper doesn't mean, you know, the basic motivations and modus operandi hasn't remained the same. You know, it's really hard to imagine what it's like to be a black young person, you know, behind the wheel of a car just going around you about your business. But I'll tell you what, as a father, I could relate to how worried I would be if my son were black and he were just out there in the world driving around, just because we just see it all too often that the people, not just law enforcement, but all kinds of people, immediately leap to the worst possible conclusion. Yeah. You know, and it's something that I never had to face. When an officer approaches me in a car, come on, you know, it's like, what am I going to do? Talk your ear off, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's the biggest threat. But, it's really hard to put yourself in the position of somebody who is a woman, who is a racial minority, and experiences this in a way. My wife, for example, she was a professional in the hospitality industry and consulting and so on. She never had a job in which a boss didn't overtly and inappropriately try to make a move on her. Not a one. I mean, I found that to be astonishing because it doesn't surprise me that it happens. But she never had.
Is your wife attractive?
Yeah, she is.
I feel like that's
so
almost
she's asking for. Is that what
that's not what I'm saying. No.
But you know what I'm saying? It's like that came as a surprise to me that there wasn't one job that didn't happen to her.
Yeah, I feel like though that's almost like a biological type of thing. Women don't pursue men. Men have to pursue women, and you have to give it a go if you're like, hey,
we got brains and we've got rules that we put in place to behave ourselves. You know what I mean?
If you can't be like obviously touching somebody inappropriately or, you know, making comments reason.
I don't think anybody's got a problem with that. And that's not what she's talking about. She's talking about guys like groping, chasing around, the old cliche, chasing around the desk.
Yeah.
That stuff really happens.
Yeah. I don't know if it happens as much anymore, though. I think we've come a long way in a few years.
I don't know what you base that on. You know, I'd like to. There should be a woman in the room here to answer that question. You know what I'm saying? So for you to say that we think we've come a long way doesn't mean a whole lot.
I suppose it's anecdotal because I'm using my experience.
Your secondhand experience.
Because
you're not a woman.
Right. Okay, fair enough. But I don't buy it. I don't think I think things have never been better, and I wish that people would say things are getting better. and I acknowledge how it's getting better, and it's going to get better in the future too.
I totally agree with you there. That I do agree with. I think there's no doubt that we're safer, we're more civil than we've ever been before. This is a great time to be alive. And the fact that we have so little tolerance, what you might call political correctness, or you know that people still get worked up about domestic violence and sexual violence and sexual harassment, it may seem like it's overdone, but I think it's a really healthy sign that even as things are getting better, we have less tolerance for all those things. Bullying is a perfect example, right? I mean, it wasn't even an issue when we were kids. It was when I was a kid. It was just kind of, it was something that happened.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a topic.
Yeah.
But now it's a really big deal, and we're watching it. And I know that the incidence of bullying is really going down. But I don't think there's anything wrong with like kind of trying to have almost a zero tolerance policy for all these things, because we're capable of that. We really are. We're capable of having a much more fair and civil society.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that you should have happen to you as a man is you should get beat up at least one time and kick somebody's ass at least one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think about that. Yeah, I mean, maybe even if it's in the ring, right?
Sure.
It doesn't have to be on the street.
I can work with that. Yeah.
I agree. I think it's really important to know what it feels like to get punched in the nose,
mm-hmm.
and that spreading, radiating feeling of that salty snot that you taste. It's really, and your lip starts to puff up. You got to know what that feels like.
And
just
most
for
people,
empathy reasons, if nothing else.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. But most people are not going to step into the ring, especially the younger kids now. They don't fight. They don't like violence. And, you know, I'm not an advocate for violence. But sometimes you just need to punch somebody in the face. That was what my dad told me. If a kid's messing with you, sock him in the face.
Yeah, well, there's a time and a place, I suppose. I'm not going to advocate punching. But what I do worry about is, and this is where I think a political correctness does become damaging. You know, if some people are annoyed by political correctness, I don't have any sympathy for them. Too bad. Be annoyed. But when a kid shows up to school with a guitar pick or something like that, and the police are called because he's got a weapon,
chooses Pop-Tart.
This is traumatic. That's abuse of that kid. And also, to take that further, the school to prison pipeline thing you've heard so much about. This really happens. These are kids, more often minorities than not minorities, who are treated much more harshly. They're suspended more quickly than merits, you know, fairness. And this gets kids started in the wrong direction right off the bat, and it's very damaging. So I think that's an area that we've really gone too far. When I was a kid with my brothers, we would break into the gymnastics room at the high school around the corner and set up the trampolines in the middle of the night and drink beers in there.
That sounds awesome.
And we got caught by the police, and they told us to skedaddle.
Yeah.
That was the end of it.
Right.
Can you believe today it would be, you know, they would probably charge you as an adult
mm-hmm.
for felony breaking and entering.
Yeah.
You know, so... that's a shame that I don't think we balance those things as well as we should, especially with kids.
Yeah, I guess so. I kind of feel like I'm afraid being in the radio and, you know, you do broadcasting. I know I'm going to say something at some point because I'm trying to be funny. And I know that I'm going to offend somebody or say something that's going to piss somebody off. And I'm wondering how I'm going to deal with that when it comes. Hopefully it won't. But I'm fully expecting that to happen. And I feel like people take things out of context, maybe, and assume they put their own meaning on what you said, as opposed to what you actually said. And then they can call you a bigot for that.
Yeah. I don't know what the answer is. We were talking earlier. I was listening to Adam Carolla on the way down here, who I'm a big fan of. And he's taken a lot of criticism. He's been accused of being sexist and racist and homophobic and inappropriate references to the disabled, the whole panoply. And he's not that different from any other comic, from most other comics who basically, you know, make light of all these subjects. And he's weathered it, and I think he's brought a sort of sincerity to it that that really sustains him. And my advice to you would be, you know, you want to be funny and you want to entertain people and stuff. But so if your humor comes from a real place, you know what I mean? It's like you're not just saying something that you don't believe to get a rise out of somebody. I think that's where you get yourself in trouble. If you say something you believe, even if it's offensive to a lot of people, stand by it, you know? This is still America.
Yeah.
And I think you should have the freedom to do that. And you take your lumps, you know?
Right. Sarah Silverman was one of the people who, she got in a lot of trouble years ago for a Chinese comment. She said something about on Jimmy Kimmel, like, oh, I pee pee in your Coke. And they got really upset. The Chinese government demanded an apology from the administration. And they said, well, we don't really deal with our comedians. It's
right,
not in our
right.
jurisdiction.
Yeah, right.
She now has been like, yeah, I'm not using words anymore. I'm stepping back. Like, she's the face of stand-up comedy. Mm. To me, like, if you look on her Wikipedia of stand-up comedy, she's there. She's on the picture there for that. And it concerns me that she is self-censoring because you are going to miss out on a lot of good jokes.
That's true. But we have a long tradition in this country of ethnic artists lampooning their own ethnicity. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
the Jewish comics
sure.
are make Jewish jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Joe Coy, you know, he can affect that sort of stereotypical Asian accent, you know, the restaurant owner. Because that's his experience. When you start doing that for other people, that's where I think you step into dangerous territory. Right?
I just don't think it's... I think criticism... And there's a difference, too, between being critical and being hateful, too. I feel like just because you're not of a certain ethnic or a sex, you shouldn't be able to speak on it because you're not that. That's going to make things worse than better. We should right. have open dialogues and talk to each other.
I agree with that. There's absolutely, but where I think white guys get in trouble is by being clueless. Let me give you an example. If you want to a crude example, if you want to say a joke that has that stereotypical Chinese, you know, accent, Hop Sing from Bonanza. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
You better realize that those stereotypes were real and they were really very hateful and, you know, they were dead serious, you know, when the Chinese were trying to assimilate and they were coming here in the 1800s and so on. The same with, you know, the N-word. And if you're going to play with that, if you're going to play with that dynamite, you better be fully aware of all the dimensions of it. Gosh, there was something, I'll think of it, but, you know, when people are clueless because they don't know their history. You know, they don't know, you know, that there were slurs that were used. For example, using the term boy, you know, that might be harmless. You might call your white friend, he's my boy. You know, there's a history to that. The blackface thing, guys on Halloween, right? They, you know, Ted Danson went in blackface on Halloween and it was a big deal. You know, people were really kind of outraged. You could argue, you could yell political correctness, but he doesn't realize that was a humiliation for a whole generation of African Americans to watch white actors put shoe polish on their face and act like idiots. You know what I mean?
I do, but I can't also think of anybody that's publicly spoke out against it either.
Against what?
Of blackface. And I don't know. I was reading this book by Thaddeus Russell called... damn it. I forget the title of it now. But it's something... shit, it's in my bedroom. But anyways, it talks about...
We're not going in your bedroom, Will. I didn't sign up for that.
That's okay. I don't blame you. You don't want to do that. But anyway, oh, not a people's history. Forget it. I don't know. But it talks about how a lot of it was used in... because white actors couldn't get away with singing and dancing. Because it wasn't proper of that time. It wasn't proper for white folk to do that. But black folk could get away with it because that was their culture. They sang and danced and drank. So they would, obviously racism, they wouldn't allow a black actor to use that role. So they would in turn use that as a way of getting around that thing. So it was actually in tribute more than racism.
Oh, gosh. That sounds hinky to me, man. I'm sorry.
And I'll give you the book.
And the important, but the important thing is if some of these people thought they were doing a tribute to their African-American brothers, fine. I'm very skeptical that represented very many. But it's the way it lands on the ear of the person being depicted. A perfect example is, and again, I'll probably make some enemies on this, but the Washington Redskins, you know? I don't even know why we're talking about this anymore, because there's no doubt that Native Americans find that offensive, and it's a racial slur to them, just like the N-word would be to a black person. Yet this team persists in calling themselves that. You could talk about history and tribute and all kinds of things. Seminoles are a whole different thing. Seminole is not a slur word. It's the name of a tribe.
Mm-hmm.
But Redskins is very clearly a historic slur. So, you know, there's just no defense for that in my mind, just because unless you're an American Indian, I think you have to defer to what that community wants in this case.
So maybe they should change their name to the Apaches or something like that. Would that be acceptable if they did that?
I guess, but, you know, yeah. I guess that should be fine. If they wanted to pay tribute to the Apaches, that's fine. Because that's a whole different thing than Redskins.
Yeah. I've also heard, though, that a lot of Native Americans don't really care, too. There's some people that are very vocal about it, but there's also a large majority that it doesn't really bother them that much.
Yeah, but that doesn't change the equation. What, do you have to have 100% opposition from the, you know, that's,
well, how
that's
much
not
do you
the
have
standard.
To have? How much do you have to have, then, to change something? 20%? Like, where do you draw the line where it's cool with some and not cool with others?
It's not for us white guys to decide that. It's because, again, it's depicting this culture. It's depicting this minority. I think the more important thing is you don't have any Native Americans in any numbers coming out in support of this. They're just not there.
I've seen some. I can send you some stuff online.
The exception that proves the rule. There's always, it's a big world. There's going to be somebody that's.
This is what I was saying, like alluding to earlier, is that you can find one thing and you're like, oh my God. And then you can find something else that completely.
But my question to you, Will, is why do you care? I mean, what do you.
I don't really care.
Well, it sounds like you do. It sounds like you have an opinion on this that they should be allowed to keep that name.
I don't really care.
Oh, okay.
I really don't care.
I misunderstood. But
if they change it tomorrow, I wouldn't
yeah,
care.
I mean, that's the way I feel because I don't have a dog in that fight.
Yeah. It bugs me that people care too much about stuff, honestly. I feel like I'm passionate about not being passionate.
All right.
About,
well,
a lot of stuff.
Hey, let me, I know we don't have, you know, all night, but just one thing about being married, my wife and I have a rule. Whenever we sort of have a disagreement about something, we decide who feels more strongly about it. And mm-hmm. the person who feels more strongly about it wins. And that generally works, settles the argument.
That's a good strategy.
Now, if the same person is always the one that feels strongly, then it doesn't work, right? You know, you have to have a little give and take.
Yeah.
But it's a good way of working things out. And this is the way I think a lot of these sort of PC things like the Washington Redskins should be done. It's like, who cares more about it? And I think it's, you know, I think it's the Native Americans who see that and can't believe, you know, this is still going on. So maybe that's how you make decisions.
All right, white guy, making the decisions. All right, man, I'll let you get out of here. Brendan, thank you very much for coming in, dude. I appreciate it. Come back.
I enjoyed it, Will. Good
You're like,
talk.
No, I won't come back.
Good talk, good meeting. Who knows?
All right, man,
good
thank
luck
you.
To you.
So, yeah, this has been HMB Sides with Brendan McLaughlin, hmbradio.com. You can get all that extra info, James Bailey's My Mom's Favorite Podcast, and more shows to come. So I will talk to you later. Bye. Superhighways, coast to coast, easy to get.